in the limelight.
The Democracy Summit demonstrates that Washington's alleged commitment to freedom and democratic values as a key feature of U.S. foreign policy is as inconsistent and hypocritical as ever, says Ted Galen Carpenter Ryder in an article titled The Truth of Biden's Fraudulent Democracy Summit. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Washington's much ballyhoo virtual Democracy Summit on December 9th and 10th is already generating justifiable criticism. Centering U.S. foreign policy on democracy promotion, rhetorically, if not substantively, brings back memories of George W. Bush's ill-fated effort. Playing the democracy card has also exacerbated already serious tensions between the Biden administration and Russia and China. Both powers interpret the summit as an effort to enlist other nations in a hostile containment policy directed against them. The worst feature for summit, though, is the brazen hypocrisy of U.S. policy on democracy. True, this has been a long-standing, embarrassing characteristic of Washington's foreign policy. Many of the free world allies that U.S. leaders embraced, funded, and armed throughout the Cold War were actually brutal and corrupt tyrants. What mattered to U.S. officials was that those regimes were reliably anti-communist and especially anti-Soviet. The nature of their domestic rule could be and usually was overlooked. The invitation list to Biden's summit underscores that the U.S. double standard on democracy is alive and well. Although the administration excluded all of the governments that are obvious, indisputable autocracies, some of the invitees warranted a reaction of surprise, if not outright disgust, from people truly committed to democratic norms. Despite the State Department's own reports confirming that the Philippines is frequently guilty of extrajudicial killings and other civil liberties abuses, representatives of the government participated in the summit. Likewise, India and Brazil were given the honor of providing input on democracy promotion despite their own dramatic backsliding into authoritarian practices in recent years. Kosovo also made the invitation list, even though key members of the country's political elite faced charges of war crimes and crimes against humanity before an international tribunal. Charges in this case include the systematic murder of prisoners of war to sell their organs on the international black market. A clear pattern emerges regarding inclusions and exclusions, especially in murky or marginal cases. Two types of governments make the invitation list even when there are serious questions about their own commitment to democracy. In the first category are the significant geopolitical players that Washington is courting for strategic objectives. This category is why there was almost no chance India or Brazil would be snubbed. U.S. leaders want India to become an active member of a containment policy directed against China. Both the Trump and Biden administrations lobbied aggressively to convert the quadrilateral security dialogue, commonly known as the Quad, which has Japan, Australia, India, and the United States as members, into a military alliance for that purpose. Although the Quad has conducted a growing number of joint military exercises, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has thus far refrained from making that policy commitment, but Washington's courtship continues. Brazil is a key economic and political player in the Western Hemisphere, and Washington is especially concerned about President Jair Bolsonaro's government and its growing economic ties with Russia and China. Given this geopolitical context, Biden administration officials will not allow defects in either country's domestic governance to be an obstacle for strategic objectives. The way for smaller countries with highly questionable democratic credentials to get Washington's imprimatur for the Democracy Summit was to obediently follow the U.S. lead on important international issues. It is notable, for example, that Poland and even Ukraine received invitations to the conclave, but NATO member Hungary did not. Granted, there is little question that Hungary's government under Prime Minister Viktor Orban has displayed growing autocratic tendencies. However, Poland has exhibited smaller troubling behavior, albeit in slightly milder form. There is one glaring difference, though. Warsaw enthusiastically embraces Washington's confrontational policy toward Russia, while Budapest is far more ambivalent. Washington's hypocrisy is even more evident in Ukraine's summit invitation. Ukraine has been even more blatant than Hungary in silencing opposing media outlets and committing other civil liberties abuses. In its 2021 report on political freedoms, Freedom House gives Hungary a score of 69, putting it in the partially free category. But Ukraine receives an even more anemic score of 60, continuing its steady decline over the past several years. Indeed, several of Washington's other invitees do not fare well either. India's score is 67, the Philippines 56, Kosovo 54, and Pakistan a dismal 37, barely keeping that country out of the unfree category. However, Washington has decided to treat Ukraine as a NATO member in everything but name and make Kiev a frontline ally against Russia. Consequently, Ukraine's deterioration of democratic values and practices is considered immaterial. Such a flagrant double standard should embarrass the Biden administration. The Democracy Summit demonstrates that Washington's alleged commitment to freedom and democratic values as a key feature of U.S. foreign policy is as inconsistent and hypocritical as ever. Biden and his advisors richly deserve whatever scorn they receive.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Scores of Palestinians have been injured by Israeli settlers in villages around the city of Nablus in the occupied West Bank following a shooting near an illegal outpost in Homesh that left one settler dead and two wounded. Dozens of Israeli settlers attacked Qaryut village south of Nablus overnight. The attackers broke into many homes in the town and assaulted local families. Scores of Palestinians were injured in the process and moved to several hospitals in Nablus. According to the Palestinian media, the settlers also blocked the main highway connecting Nablus and Ramallah and attacked vehicles with Palestinian license plates with the stones, causing damages to several cars. In reaction to the attacks, the Palestinian Ministry of Foreign Affairs and Expatriates called on the United Nations to promptly activate the international protection system for Palestinian civilians under Israeli occupation. It also called on the international community to pressure the Israeli regime into stopping acts of terrorism committed by settlers against Palestinians and their communities. The ministry held the regime of Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett fully and directly responsible for settler violence and terror, and warned against the dangerous repercussions of their acts on the status of the region. It is stressed that Israeli authorities are encouraging and protecting settler violence, which is soaring on a daily basis. According to Israeli advocacy group B'Tselem, 2021 saw a rise in settler violence of 28.6% compared to last year. UN human rights experts have expressed alarm at the rising rate of violence directed by Israeli settlers toward Palestinians in the occupied Palestinian territory. According to the United Nations Office for the Coordination of the Humanitarian Affairs, already in the first 10 months of 2021, there have been 410 attacks by settlers against Palestinians. 4 Palestinians were killed by settlers this year. Nearly 700,000 Israelis live in over 230 settlements built since the 1967 occupation of the Palestinian territories of the West Bank. All the settlements are illegal under international law, and the United Nations Security Council has condemned the settlement activities in several resolutions. Since occupying the West Bank, Israel has misappropriated more than 200,000 hectares of land there for its own purposes, including building and expanding settlements and paving roads for settlers. Some areas have been taken over by the regime issuing military orders, others through daily acts of settler violence. These two seemingly unrelated tracks are both forms of state violence. The Israeli apartheid regime and its representatives actively aid and abet the settlers' violence as part of his strategy to cement the takeover of Palestinian land.
The settlers and the uniformed soldiers work together, not without tensions, but they always support each other. And the settlers are used to carry out the particular kinds of attacks, burning trees, certain kinds of terror attacks, which the army prefers not to do. They shoot, they kill, but they protect the settlers 100% of the time. The settlers know this, and it gives them a sense of complete impunity.
Last week, the U.S. Under Secretary of State Victoria Nuland and an Israeli minister who is responsible for police discussed the increase in settler violence against Palestinians. That drew rebukes from pro-settlement ministers and right-wing opposition lawmakers within the Israeli regime. Omer Bar-Lev later pushed back his critics, saying they were having difficulty looking in the mirror and that settler violence has become an issue on the international stage. But Israel's Prime Minister Naftali Bennett jumped in to say it's just a marginal issue. In a tweet on Tuesday, he noted that there are marginal elements in every community and they should be dealt with using all means, but we must not generalize about an entire community. The Combatants for Peace group, which brings together Israeli and Palestinian victims of violence, condemned Bennett for his Tuesday comments, charging that the Prime Minister had given full backing to depraved settler violence, which has reached new heights under his watch. The group added that Bennett gave a green light to the Wild West atmosphere in the territories. Also, an interview published on Wednesday revealed what Israeli Foreign Minister thinks about this issue. He told an American periodical earlier this month that extremist violence is a stain on Israel amid a noted rise in violent attacks by Israeli settlers against Palestinians.
There is a situation in the West Bank which is lawless. You might consider the situation to be one of no legal protection for Palestinians whatsoever.
Bennett's marginalization of the issue was aimed at legitimizing and praising settler violence, which is soaring on a daily basis. Let's not forget that Israeli soldiers and police usually defend the attackers or simply stand to the side when they assault Palestinians. Therefore, settler violence is a central issue that requires urgent attention from the international community to put an end to it.
Morgan, Helen Margaret Lillian, Liberal Democrats, 17,957.
In another setback for the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, his Conservative Party has lost its North Shropshire seat to Liberal Democrats in a by-election, the constituency the Tories dominated for nearly 200 years. In her victory speech, Helen Morgan said the results reflect the British people's views about the Conservative Party.
Tonight, the people of North Shropshire have spoken on behalf of the British people. They've said loudly and clearly, Boris Johnson, the party is over.
The Liberal Democrats, in my view, have never been an alternative to the Conservative Party. They're really there's very little difference between the policies of the Liberal Democrats and Conservatives. In other words, when the Conservatives lose credibility, they bring out the Liberal Democrats who are sort of centrist, never represented any concrete or coherent alternative to the Conservative Party.
Conservative lawmaker Roger Gale also says the by-election can be regarded as a referendum on the Prime Minister's performance. The by-election was called after the former MP for North Shropshire stepped down for breaching the Parliament's paid lobbying rules. The British government tried to avert the resignation by changing the rules, but later faced a backlash and was forced to backtrack. That was only one in the long list of issues raising questions about Boris Johnson's leadership. Opposition politicians accused Johnson of being a serial liar and incompetent leader, with some demanding that he resign.
Clearly, the vote in North Shropshire.
Boris Johnson acknowledged that the shocking results of the North Shropshire by-election contained a message for him and his party.
I'm responsible for everything that the government does. And of course, I take
so which
personal
bit?
Responsibility.
But there's too much responsibility to shoulder, as Boris Johnson's tenure has been replete with a spate of allegations and scandals. The Premier stands accused of breaking the law by using Conservative Party donations to renovate his residence at No. 11 Downing Street. He's also under pressure for reported parties in his office last Christmas, disregarding the very COVID-19 restrictions the government had imposed. British dailies The Guardian and The Independent have also reported that Boris Johnson himself joined a pizza party in Downing Street in May last year amid the first nationwide lockdown. The Premier is also under fire for his handling of the pandemic. On Tuesday, he suffered a humiliating rebellion from Conservative lawmakers over measures to curb the spread of the Omicron variant of the coronavirus. In addition, damaging disclosures have surfaced about some of the Conservative MPs who've moonlighted as political consultants or advisors, raking in tens of thousands of pounds by lobbying. The metaphorical pendulum in Britain's domestic politics appears to be swinging to the other side. The Conservatives have a couple of years to stop that from happening.
Inflation in the UK has risen to its highest level in 10 years. The cost of living has surged by 5.1% in the 12 months to November, up from 4.2% the month before. This was the steepest increase for a decade and more than doubles the central bank's target. Increase in costs for fuel, energy, clothing, and secondhand cars were indicative of the rise in inflation. Economists had expected an inflation of 4.7% for the month of November, and the Bank of England had projected that inflation would hit 5% in the spring of 2022, before moderating towards its 2% target in late 2023.
We haven't seen inflation at this level for many decades. The highest level I can remember actually was back in the 1970s, when it reached 25%. So 5% is still very high, but nothing near that level. But it's still double the level that the Bank of England expected, of just over 2.5%. And so it's going to be very difficult to try and adjust to it. Now, the question is, of course, is this going to be embedded inflation and carried on, as we saw in the 1970s, or is it just rolled off after 12 months because of individual price increases?
It is believed that global supply chain problems, staff shortages, and rapid demand for oil and gas have all driven up prices. The end of COVID support schemes and Brexit have also played a part. In November, petrol prices jumped to the highest ever recorded, while the cost of used cars jumped due to shortages of new vehicles. The UK fuel poverty has further increased due to the increase in energy costs, putting further strain on the average UK family.
And those supply chain issues take a long time to work their way through. Most recently we had, for instance, a shortage of lorry drivers, and only now we're beginning to see our way through the other side of that, so it's taken 3 or 4 months to work its way through. Other issues of supply chain will be much longer, as a lot of businesses will try and shorten their supply routes, supply chains, and de-risk their supply chains, and that means more localization, local product production, and maybe less trade coming out of, say, the Far East and other areas like that. So global trade was designed in such a way, it was like an elastic band, very efficient and very taut. But unfortunately, when that elastic band breaks, it's very difficult to replace quickly.
The rising inflation has sparked an outcry from Britain's Unite trade union. It says many workers face an effective pay cut with the prospect of below-inflation annual wage increases. The Unite union has urged companies to grant pay hikes that preserve the buying power of salary.
Well, what we've seen, obviously, is oil price rising, particularly gas. And unfortunately for the British public, they've got a nasty shock coming in the spring when the government-imposed cap on the gas price is taken off. And a lot of people see their prices of gas nearly double in value, which is going to be very painful for them indeed. So this is working its way through the system. We're going to see higher wage rises coming through. And this has particularly hit people at the weaker end of society, those who are poorer paid. Well, if nothing else, it means they're going to get paid more. But unfortunately, not in real terms, because even if you get a 4% pay rise, which has been suggested for many, when you've got inflation at over 5%, you're still losing money.
Current estimates suggest that costs for the typical UK family will jump by £1,700 in the year 2022. But Labour claim the government is not doing nearly enough to tackle the problem, especially as further inflationary pressures from rising energy costs are coming down the line. Omicron, which emerged late last month, forced Britain to reimpose coronavirus restrictions that were passed by lawmakers late on Tuesday. The UK economy was already struggling prior to the arrival of Omicron, growing by 0.1% in October from 0.6% in September. The International Monetary Fund warned Tuesday that new COVID-19 variants pose downside risks to the outlook for Britain, urging the government to consider new emergency stimulus measures in the event of fresh lockdowns. The IMF predicted inflation would reach around 5.5% early next year, its highest in 30 years, and warned the bank not to succumb to inaction bias. Economists have warned that the supply chain disruptions will continue to disrupt economic activity, leading to sharp price increases at least through the year 2022. This phenomenon is not unique to just the UK. The US and many other parts of the world are also suffering from inflation, from food prices to energy costs.
After a chaotic end to its disastrous war in Afghanistan, failure of America's longest military mission is fueling a heated debate about U.S. militarism. The war dragged on for 2 decades and cost American taxpayers over $2.3 trillion. Thousands of American troops lost their lives, and many more were injured in the protracted military campaign that's been widely described as a fiasco. The war wreaked havoc on Afghanistan, with tens of thousands of civilians losing their lives or limbs. On August the 30th, the United States withdrew from Afghanistan after a terrible loss to the enemy it invaded Afghanistan to defeat. There is absolutely no doubt that the Afghan mission ended in failure. Afghanistan was the first country attacked by America as part of its so-called war on terror launched by former President George W. Bush. Almost none of the stated goals of the Afghan mission were ever fulfilled. In late September, America's highest-ranking general, Chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff Mark Milley, said during a Senate hearing that the U.S. pullout, with the Taliban back in power, is quote-unquote a strategic failure.
America's weakness has been exposed to the world. I mean, essentially, America's incompetence, its military weakness, its lack of foresight, was exposed as a result of the chaotic pullout of Afghanistan. America, it was shown that America had no idea why it was there. It had no clear goals. It lacked the military means to for subduing the other Taliban. And all it could do was spread destruction. So that is essentially exposes the incredible weakness of the American empire.
Many Americans are still looking for answers. What brought their country to this part of the world? And what kept it fighting a futile war for two decades? Meanwhile, the U.S. is definitely not taking responsibility for the mess that it left behind in this volatile region as huge waves of Afghan refugees overwhelm neighboring countries and beyond. The United States has fought many wars during its history. Over the past decades, most U.S. military missions have been criticized for not going as planned. The Afghan mission became particularly notorious for lack of strategy and proper planning. U.S. lawmakers have launched a commission to study the Afghanistan fiasco. This week, the U.S. Congress voted to set up a commission to assess the failures during the 20-year war. The commission was part of an annual military package passed by the Senate on Wednesday after approval last week by the House of Representatives. The bipartisan Commission on Afghanistan will have 16 members. It faces a deadline to issue an initial report within a year of its first meeting and a final report within 3 years. The legislation said, quote, "The commission shall conduct a comprehensive assessment of the war in Afghanistan and make recommendations to inform future operations with tactical and strategic lessons learned, including the impact of troop increases and decreases, and date certain deadlines." The congressional panel will also study George W. Bush's launch of the war, as well as American policy on Afghanistan in the years before the mission.
We can be rest assured it will be unperceptive, unanalytical, and unintelligent. That seems to be quite clear. The U.S. is incapable of learning. It's incapable of learning from its past mistakes. It's destined to keep on making the same mistakes over and over again.
The United States seems to be reflecting on its longest war months after the chaotic pullout. Will it learn from its long list of failures in Afghanistan?
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. Or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we discussed Imam Khomeini's guidelines on the way of political activities of armed forces and said that he was strongly against involvement of the armed forces in political parties. Thus, he would warn the Iranian armed forces against supporting or opposing any specific political group or establishment. Today we are going to present you other parts of the Imam's guidelines on the issue. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, insistently warned the armed forces against political rivalries due to the fact that it would cause disruption in the structure of the armed forces and would seriously undermine unity of these forces. He writes in his testament, "The very entering a party for the army, the IRGC, the military and police is not permitted. It will lead them to corruption. The founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran believed that any involvement of the armed forces in parties or factions would eclipse national interest." He writes, "The Islamic Revolution Guards Corps and other armed forces should not enter political affairs so that solidarity is fulfilled. If you enter, you would finally trouble yourselves and would finally stand against one another and would trouble the system and would weaken Islam." Imam Khomeini stressed that every component of the Islamic system should fulfill their own duties without interfering in the affairs of other parts. He writes in another part of his testament, "The duty of every military and garrison is to avoid meddling in the political affairs of the state, because if a soldier enters political affairs, he will lose his duty as a soldier. Thus, the enemies want to cause problems in the core of the army. One of the big problems is to bring political affairs in the army so that they start speaking political words. I order the army commanders that political issues should not be raised in the army." Imam Khomeini, as the commander-in-chief of the armed forces of the Islamic Republic of Iran, emphatically told the Parliament and the Supreme Defense Council that they are religiously obligated to prevent the involvement of the military in political affairs. He writes, "Since the revolution belongs to the whole nation and it is everyone's duty to safeguard it, the religious and national duty of the government, the nation, the Defense Council, and the Assembly of Islamic Council or Parliament is to oppose from the very first step. If the armed forces, whether the commanders or the higher and lower ranks, want to do anything against the interests of Islam and the country or enter in parties which would undoubtedly destroy them. And it is incumbent upon the leader and the leadership council to prevent this issue decisively so that the country is immune from damage." Imam Khomeini was so sensitive toward the involvement of armed forces in political affairs that some paragraphs were inserted in the law of punishment of the armed forces. In a part of the law, it has been made clear that the membership of the military personnel in any party or political organization and group will lead to 6 months to 3 years of imprisonment. Moreover, in the law for presidential election, it reads that the law enforcement forces should do their duties on ballot boxes to keep order, but they should seriously refrain from taking stances for or against any specific candidate. Furthermore, Articles 47 and 48 of the Bylaw of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps stress that the IRGC is completely independent from any political party or group and should never find a partisan identity to act as a political party or organization. It stresses that the members of the IRGC have no right to be a member of any political party, group, or organization, and this continuation of membership will cause them to be expelled from the IRGC. Dear listeners, that marks the end of this episode. Next time, we will continue the discussion.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
The largest international gathering on Afghanistan since the US left the country in a chaotic situation. The extraordinary meeting of the OIC foreign ministers was convened in Islamabad to discuss the humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan. The meeting was attended by not just the OIC states, but permanent members of the UN Security Council, representatives of the UN agencies, and the international financial institutions. Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan called for the immediate help for the people of Afghanistan.
The point is that if the world does not act, this will be the biggest man-made crisis which is unfolding in front of us. We, the OIC, it's a big responsibility on us, because not only is it the situation in Afghanistan as it unfolds, but it's a religious duty to help them.
The UN Under Secretary General on Humanitarian Affairs, presented a grim picture of the Afghan situation.
Basic services that all Afghans depend on are collapsing as international development support, upon which the country has depended for so long, has frozen up. By the middle of next year, as estimated by UNDP, universal poverty may reach 97%.
The Iranian foreign minister proposed the establishment of a special fund to help the people of Afghanistan. He also called for the national reconciliation and inclusive government in Afghanistan. This was the second extraordinary meeting of the OIC on Afghanistan. The first one was also held in Islamabad 41 years ago, but the agenda at that time was to penalize the Soviet-backed regime in Kabul.
The meeting of the OIC foreign ministers came against the backdrop of worsening humanitarian situation in Afghanistan. According to the United Nations, nearly 23 million Afghans are facing acute food shortage. 97% of Afghan population could slip below the poverty line by June next year if urgent steps are not taken to mitigate their sufferings.
The acting Afghan foreign minister was also invited to the meeting. Officials say at this stage the priority is to avert the humanitarian crisis and the question of recognition of the Taliban rule will come later. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Anger was vented outside Downing Street Sunday as Britain's ethnic minorities demanded the government scrap the controversial new Nationality and Border Bill. The bill gifts the state new powers to remove citizenship without warning or a proper appeal process. Black, Asian and immigrant families are all expected to be targeted disproportionately by the new law change, sending fear ricocheting through communities.
Basically, what they're saying is that all that we've been working for as organizations, as generations of Muslims who exist in this country, belong to this country, whatever you've done doesn't really matter. You're a second-class citizen. And that is a dangerous narrative that they're presenting us with.
The fact that even though you're a British citizen, you're still affected if you're still from an ethnic minority country. So the fact that you're a member of the Sikh community, Muslim community, Hindu community, Black community, you're not really safe here.
As members of the public, as just citizens of Britain, we are just pawns, mere pawns to them in their political games. Our lives are at stake, and that is not an exaggeration.
Despite government reassurances, critics have warned that the new bill could affect an estimated 6 million Britons who were born elsewhere or have a second nationality, and could be used by the state to punish minority citizens they want to get rid of.
The bill has already passed through the House of Commons at its third reading earlier this month. It's now been passed onto the House of Lords, where it will be debated further on January the 5th. The result of that debate could determine whether so many British citizens, particularly from ethnic minorities, can maintain their nationality going forward. Robert Carter, London.
An investigation into the confidential documents of the U.S. military has laid bare horrifying facts about the American air war in West Asia. The New York Times says it has reviewed more than 1,300 records drawn from a hidden Pentagon archive, and all that has shed more light on how U.S. airstrikes have resulted in thousands of civilian deaths in Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan, but have gone mostly underreported. Based on the U.S. military's own count, air raids have killed some 1,600 civilians in these countries over the past years. And even though the Times does not give a figure, it does say that the military has drastically undercounted the tally. A particular case that's been highlighted is a 2016 attack on a hamlet in northern Syria that the U.S. military said killed 85 Daesh terrorists. But as it turned out later, the victims were in fact 120 farmers and villagers. The high number of civilian deaths also hints at the deeply flawed intelligence plaguing the U.S. bombing campaign, as well as the hasty and imprecise targeting that is in sharp contrast to precision bombs and eagle-eyed drones propagated by the U.S. military. It also brings into question the Pentagon's claims of transparency and accountability. Based on the report, only a few assessments of faulty raids have been made public, and surprisingly, none have found any wrongdoing or led to disciplinary action. A more recent example is the U.S. drone strike that took the lives of 10 members of an Afghan family, 7 of them children, in Kabul back in August. The Pentagon initially claimed that terrorists had been killed. Then it was forced to admit that the attack had been a tragic mistake, taking civilian lives. But eventually, it decided that no one would be punished for the erroneous strike. The New York Times says it has visited nearly 100 casualty sites in Iraq, Syria, and Afghanistan, and interviewed scores of survivors to compile the report. Even though many civilian survivors now have to live with disabilities that require expensive treatment, only fewer than a dozen have received compensation. Despite such a terrible record, the U.S. keeps up with its air campaigns mostly in Muslim nations. Scott Bennett, a former U.S. Army officer, believes it is time the international community moved to stop the U.S. war machine from spilling more innocent blood.
When is the world going to stand up and stop allowing the U.S. to call every other nation a state sponsor of terrorism and say that the United States is indeed the state sponsor of terrorism globally, because it is engaged in the destruction of the world? When is the world going to stand up and tell the truth?
The U.S. Army carried out more than 50,000 airstrikes in Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan between 2014 and 2019. The aim was allegedly to eliminate militants and terrorists and bring peace and stability to those countries. But those bombardments brought nothing other than death and destruction. And the U.S. has kept killing civilians with impunity and without accountability.
Yemen's capital Sana'a has hosted an exhibition on those who have lost their lives in the fight against the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. Thousands of Yemenis have visited the exhibition, which was held in the occasion of Yemen's Martyrs Week. The organizers of the exhibition highlighted the importance of unity among resistance groups in the region in the face of U.S.-backed aggressions.
The sacrifices made by these martyrs are great, and they came to end the injustice of the Yemeni people. And they are also a source of inspiration for various people to stand in the face of the invaders. And all the resistance groups should unite against the aggressors. Our martyrs stood against the invaders led by the United States and Israel and their Saudi and Emirati tools, who seek to plunder Yemeni's wealth. The martyrs are from all segments of society, and this is evidence of the sincerity of the cause that they died to defend. And Yemenis learn from this occasion the values of great sacrifice.
The Saudi-led war on Yemen, which started in March 2015, has killed tens of thousands of civilians, most of them women and children. The war has taken a heavy toll on the country's infrastructure and pushed the war-torn country to the brink of famine.
People here say they will never forget the sacrifices made by those who stood up and defended their country against the Saudi aggression till their last breath. They say Riyadh's war crimes will not go unpunished, and Saudi Arabia will be brought to justice for its atrocities. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Afghanistan's health system is on the brink of collapse, partly due to Western sanctions imposed against the Taliban. Authorities say the sources needed to produce oxygen for coronavirus patients have run out, so as the supplies of many essential drugs. Hospital workers are struggling with acute shortages, while they have not been paid for months.
U.S. sanctions against the Islamic Emirate now mean sanctioning the Afghan people. When the health sector doesn't receive enough support, and Afghanistan's assets are not freed, people's daily life becomes difficult and health services would collapse. My demand as an Afghan doctor from world countries, especially those who have blocked our assets, is that they should have a look at the economic and medical situation of the people of Afghanistan and free the money. If the US has a problem with the Taliban, it must be solved through talks rather than by pressuring our patients.
With the winter coming, hospitals will receive more patients. But nowadays, nothing is free for them, and they hardly can afford to buy food and medicines.
Before the Taliban takeover, we used to receive food and medicines, but since the Taliban have taken power, there is no food neither for patients nor for doctors. There are a few medicines available here, but doctors say most of them have already run out.
As I witnessed, first of all, most of the doctors were absent. It is said that they are disappointed because they have been unpaid for months. Second, the hospital rooms are very cold. In addition, there is a shortage of food and medicines. Patients share their food with hospital staff. It is world countries' duties to send humanitarian assistance to the Afghan health centers.
After the Taliban took over, the U.S. froze some $10 billion in assets of the Afghan Central Bank. The White House last week dismissed any immediate release of the money. The freezing of Afghan assets by the U.S. has dragged Afghanistan into hunger and the health crisis. Afghans said they have been harmed by sanctions imposed against the Taliban. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Migration, an ongoing phenomenon, seems to be endless. Countries around the world have always had to deal with migrants coming from various destinations. A broad range of factors contribute to the movement of people, including economic challenges, extreme poverty, or conflict. According to the United Nations, around 281 million people were international migrants in 2020. That represents 3.6% of the global population. In recent years, the wave of migration has taken a different turn as Europe and the United States have become the main destinations for migrants. Large numbers of people have tried to reach Europe from countries in West Asia, including Iraq and Syria, both witnessing wars in which the US and some Western states have played a big role. The US itself has faced a growing number of asylum seekers trying to reach there from Central American countries. The root causes for that include economic crises blamed on US policies towards these countries. Migration has also become a source of political tensions among countries, with the latest examples in Europe. Belarus and neighboring Poland are at odds over the situation of thousands of migrants stranded at the border. The UK and France have also locked horns over the rising number of migrants trying to cross the English Channel into Britain. All this comes as many migrants lose their lives through their perilous journey. There have been other destinations for migrants too. Iran is one of them. It hosts Afghans fleeing poverty and conflict triggered by two decades of the US-led military presence in Afghanistan that came to an end just this past August. Several millions of Afghans currently live in Iran, which, according to the UN, make one of the largest refugee populations. The world body has on various occasions hailed Iran for accepting the Afghan refugees. All in all, experts believe the global migration crisis can only be tackled through a concerted effort by countries and enough determination to end conflicts across the world.
The UN General Assembly passed a resolution on the situation of human rights in Iran. Pushed by Canada, the resolution expresses serious concern over, quote, alarmingly high rate of the imposition of death penalty in Iran, including those against child offenders. 76 countries voted in favor of the resolution, and 31 countries voted against it, while 69 others abstained. Iran's High Council for Human Rights was quick to deplore what he called a politically motivated measure replete with factual errors.
There is no international rule that bans the death penalty for people under 18. Furthermore, Article 1 of the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child defines a child as every human being below the age of 18 years, unless the national law considers majority attained at an earlier age. Well, in the Islamic Republic, a child has a different definition. So it's not illegal in Iran to execute a person under 18. Yet I should add that the number of minus 18 people who receive death penalty in Iran is insignificant.
Tehran views the new resolution as a clear example of double standards at the United Nations. The Islamic Republic urged the international body to open its eyes to the devastating effects of U.S. sanctions on the health sector in Iran. Tehran says those sanctions have denied thousands of Iranians access to life-saving medicine.
Iran is the major victim of sanctions. The United States has admitted that it has put in place an unprecedented sanctions against Iran. Isn't this a violation of human rights? Then why has the UN stopped short of condemning the illegal and unilateral sanctions on the Iranian nation? If you are so concerned about the rights of few prisoners who have committed crimes against the Iranian nation, you also need to take into account the rights of millions of Iranians who cannot access medical supplies just because of the sanctions.
Tehran also referred the UN to Canada's track record of rights abuse against the Aboriginal people, particularly disproportionate violence against indigenous women. Tehran said these are manifestations of deep-rooted colonialism, which Canada has been practicing with impunity. The Islamic Republic called on the UN to avoid a selective approach toward human rights. It said dialogue and cooperation based on mutual respect and equal footing is the only way to ensure the promotion and protection of human rights at the international level.
The Islamic Republic regards itself as a major victim of rights violation, many of which, it says, were committed by the proponents of the recent anti-Iran resolution. So Tehran says those countries are in no position to lecture others on human rights, and such resolutions will only kill the chance for constructive dialogues. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Alarm bells have rung across Britain after a Conservative MP informed pro-Israel activists of new government plans to outlaw the pro-Palestine boycott, divestment and sanctions movement. The comments were said by British lawmaker Robert Jenrick during an online conference about anti-Semitism titled "Why Do So Many People Hate Jews?"
It is, I think, becoming much more of a fringe activity. What we want to do is pass a piece of legislation here, and I'm pretty confident it will be in the next legislative program, the Queen's Speech, as we call it.
Since 2005, the boycott campaign, also known as BDS, has sought to sanction all Israeli-made products produced on illegally occupied Palestinian lands. The movement has been so successful in causing economic damage to Israel that pro-Israel groups have branded the BDS an existential threat and attempted to smear its supporters as anti-Semitic.
It's a shocking decision from the humanitarian point of view, where once again the British government is standing by the oppressor, is standing by the occupier, is standing by the criminal against the victim. It's something that it doesn't surprise, but it shocks as to how tone deaf this government is. I have absolutely no doubt whatsoever that if anything, this government has stupidly, foolishly, ridiculously, has actually afforded far more credit to BDS than it could ever have imagined.
This development would be just the latest example of a long line of attacks that this government has carried out against Palestine solidarity activism since it came into power. If they go ahead with these plans next year, then we can expect to see large-scale protest and condemnation action taking place from the many supporters of the Palestinian cause up and down the country. Robert Carter, London.
France has withdrawn from northern Mali and the historic city of Timbuktu 9 years after launching a war without the initial approval of the United Nations or even French Parliament. Mali initially became destabilized in 2011 following France's illegal arms drops to anti-Gaddafi militants in Libya. The arms were then used by Tuareg separatists who have demanded more rights ever since colonial France first dictated Mali's peculiar bow-tie-shaped borders. The war caused several thousand deaths and more than a million people to flee their homes. There have been two military coups in little over a year, while increasing demonstrations against France's presence could no longer be ignored or sufficiently repressed.
It's very difficult for France to justify its presence, even more so because the people of Mali, who are neither Tuareg nor Islamists, have been protesting France's presence in the country. So